For the tape, we're continuing on March the 6th, 2010. It is the 6th, isn't it?
Yes,
still the 6th. Okay. We're at the Big Country Intergroup Retreat in Looters, Texas. The spiritual principles of the traditions are not in our Overeaters Anonymous 12 and 12. They're documented in the Service and Traditions Manual. That can be ordered from the World Service Office. A lot of the trustees have them, and also the region chairs have them, and you can get them for yourself if you want to purchase them also, because they're to be purchased. But that's where these spiritual principles are located. Also, the 12 concepts. This is the 12 concepts of OA service pamphlet. Okay, it can also be purchased. I don't know if y'all have them here today, but this can be purchased from the World Service Office. These are where the principles of the 12 concepts of OA service. This is where they're listed. When I was serving as Region 8 trustee, I worked on the 12 concepts, and it was my suggestion that we put spiritual principles in here. So I feel a really ownership of this, you know. But anyway, that's where you can find these. But find these principles. But the thing of it is, you know, we can use these principles in all of our affairs. So that's what this is about. Now, the promises, I don't think I would be able to cover them all this weekend. I read on a website that there's 147 spiritual promises. But I'll go through some of them. But one of the things I want to talk about today is I read on page 475 in the big book. I'm going to just quote what I read this morning at 2 o'clock. From experience, I've realized that I cannot go back and make a brand new start. But through OA, I can start from now and make a brand new end. Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
A brand new end. They made copies of that willingness and trying thing. How many were you able to make?
I made 10, and I made sure each group was got one.
Okay, and then y'all can make copies also. But I want to share from the AA 12 and 12 in step 3. It's vital information about willingness. The step is, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Okay, I got a note here I want to share. I need to understand what my higher power should be. It should not be food. It should not be myself. It should be greater than food and myself. And it should contribute to abstinence and sanity in my life. That's what my higher power should be. And the term God, as used here, it does not necessarily mean that we believe in God. The term God is used only as a convenient way of referring to the spiritual power of our respective choice. And have a spiritual power, we must. It's about having a spiritual power, something that's greater than food, something that's greater than myself, something that's greater than food and myself combined, and it must contribute to my abstinence and to my sanity. God is a universal term, okay? In this step 3, made a decision. To make a decision is the ability to make up my mind and carry out my intentions. That's what a decision is. I made up my mind. I wanted to lose weight, and I went to Overeaters Anonymous. And I began to lose weight. That was my intention. That was my intention. My mind is still made up. My mind is still made up that that's what I want, and I'm continuing to carry out that intention. And so my will is my thoughts, and my life is my actions. Notice, that's what we're turning over. Our thoughts and our actions. And then in this book it says practicing step three. We have to practice step three. And that means that this is action done many times over for skill. When you're practicing something, you're trying to learn to be skillful in doing it. Okay? It says that practicing step three is like the opening of a door, which to all appearances is still closed and locked. All we need is a key and the decision. In other words, the decision, the ability to make up my mind and carry out my intentions, to swing the door open. There is only one key. And guess what it's called?
Willingness.
Willingness. There's only one key, and it is called willingness. Once unlocked by willingness, the door opens almost of itself. And looking through it, we shall see a pathway beside which is an inscription, and it reads, "This is the way to a faith that works." Faith, the spiritual principle. I need to practice that. In the first two steps, we admitted we were powerless over food and that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Those two steps, this is where we were engaged in reflection. Let's see what reflection means. What I wrote. It means a careful thought. Reflection means careful thought. You know, this is where I was engaged in careful thought about what I'm doing. We saw that we were powerless over food and that we also became aware of that faith of some kind, if only in OA itself, is possible to anyone. I'm changing the words here. But it's possible for anyone. This conclusion, in other words, this decision reached, a conclusion is a decision reached, did not require action. It required only acceptance. And acceptance means to receive willingly. I receive this information willingly. Like all the remaining steps, step three calls for affirmative action. In other words, a positive action. For it is only by action that we can cut away the self-will which has always blocked the entry of God. And self-will is seeking to satisfy one's own desires. And we need to cut that away in order for the entry of God to come in. Faith, to be sure, is necessary, but faith alone can avail nothing. You know, the big book says, faith, how does it say, student, the person? It says something about availing nothing. I can't quote it right now.
Half measures.
What? Half measures avail. You got it. Half measures avails us nothing. Okay? And this is telling us but faith alone can avail nothing. Because, you know, that would just be half measures of these spiritual principles. This faith. You know, together we can get this. Mm-hmm. And when one can't remember what something says, somebody else is going to say what it means. Thank you. Okay, we can have faith but keep God out of our lives. Therefore, our problem now becomes just how and by what specific means shall we be able to let God in. Step three represents our first attempt to do this. In fact, the effectiveness of the whole OA program will rest upon how well and earnestly we try to come to a decision. In other words, we try to have, we're going to have that ability to make up our mind and carry out our intentions, okay? And that we're going to earnestly, with deep thought and intent, this is about our thinking process, our thinking. And the effectiveness is the ability to produce a desired result without waste of time or energy to be effective. And, you know, I don't have time to waste anymore. I'm 70 years young. I mean, you know, I might not have too many more years left. Maybe so, because I come from longevity. My mama lived to 84. Her grandma lived to be 94, you know. I think my daddy would have lived a lot longer if he wouldn't have took his life in his own hands, you know, because there was longevity on that part too. But who knows, you know. But I don't want to waste time. I have too much to do. Okay, then it goes on to say, once we have placed the key of what?
Willingness
in the lock and have the door ever. The door of what? The door of faith. It's when we have the door of faith ever so slightly open. We find that we can always open it some more, though self-will may slam it shut again. Self-will can slam it shut again, as it frequently does. But it will always respond the moment we again pick up the key of
willingness.
A willingness is a disposition to do what is required. I have to have the disposition to know that I have to do this. I have to keep being willing because that's what's required of me to be able to continue to turn my will in my life, my thoughts and my actions over to the care of God. You know, so anyway, that's my little gist about that. And that y'all caught on to that so powerfully last night, it made me know that I wanted to go into that. Let me see here now. I want to go to, in the fourth edition, I want to go to page 317 and 318. I love the stories. I love the stories in the back of the book. And, you know, they tell us that they give us a clear-cut idea of how they found the power of God. That's what the stories in the back of this book is about. But I'm reading on page 317 where it says, if asked what the two most important things in recovery are, I would have to say that it's willingness and action. See, willingness alone is not going to get it. We also have to take action. Action means that we're prepared in mind, attitude, or manner. We are prepared for this. The willingness that means the willingness is that we were prepared in mind, attitude, or action, or manner. I was willing to believe that AA was telling me the truth. I wanted to believe it was true in a way I cannot relate in words. I wanted this thing to work. Then I began to take the course of action prescribed. Okay, just like I read last night on Roman numerals 12, XXI, do I believe that this can work for me? I had to believe that it would work for me. And right here is telling us that they were saying that they were willing to believe. They wanted to believe. They wanted to believe this thing. They were willing to believe this thing. And it goes on to say, following the principles laid out in the big book has not always been comfortable, nor will I claim perfection. I have yet to find a place in the big book that says, now you have completed the steps, have a nice life. This program is a plan for a lifetime of daily living. There have been occasions when the temptation to slack off has won. I view each of these as learning opportunities. There we go with our word learning again. You see, these AAs had to learn this. Us as compulsive overeaters had to learn this. Let me see if I can find. This is what I learned about principles, okay? To be sure we know what we are talking about. It is necessary to decide just what a principle really is. A principle is a fundamental or basic truth or rule. Principles are the foundation of truth, underlying the laws of nature, and especially belief systems. For the purpose of OA, principles might be thought of as basic action guidelines. They represent the belief system against which we measure thoughts or actions. Would anybody like me to repeat this? Okay. We are sure, this is principles, we are sure we know what we are talking about. To be sure, we know what we are talking about. Now, this I got this from some AA people, okay? It is necessary to decide just what a principle really is. A principle is a fundamental or basic truth or rule. Principles are the foundation of truth, underlying the laws of nature and especially belief systems. Y'all up with me?
One more time. Please.
Okay. To be sure, we know what we are talking about. That was AA's talking. It is necessary to decide just what a principle really is. A principle is a fundamental or basic truth or rule. Principles are the foundation of truth, underlying the laws of nature, and especially belief systems. For the purpose of OA, principles might be thought of as basic action guidelines. They represent the belief system against which we measure thought or actions. Got it? Okay. Well, I'm going to go back to this, but I want to say this is wonderful. Did y'all read it? So wonderful. It said God puts us at the right place at just the right time with just the right people having just the right information. Very, very useful. Good book more. Okay, I'm going to go back to page 317 where it says, when I'm willing to do the right thing, I'm rewarded with an inner peace. No amount of liquor, and for us it's food or whatever, could ever provide. When I am unwilling to do the right thing, I become what? Restless, irritable, and discontent. And isn't that the way Dr. Silkworth describes our disease? That we're restless, irritable, and discontent, unless at once followed by that sense of ease and comfort by taking that first bite. Through the 12 steps, I have been granted the gift of choice. I am no longer at the mercy of a disease that tells me the only answer is to drink. We're not at the mercy of a disease that tells us that the only answer is to eat. We're not. If willingness is the key to unlock the gates of hell, it is action that opens those doors so that we may walk freely among the living. Okay. We may have that key of willingness and we might unlock the door, but if we don't take actions, we're not going to move beyond. The door might be just open, but are we going to walk through that door? Are we going to walk through that door to freedom? And you know, I think about that spiritual arch that the Big Book describes, that we can walk through there, a free human being. They say a free man, you know, but that's just a universal term. Each one of us can walk through that arch to freedom. Over the course of my sobriety, I have experienced many opportunities to grow. I've had struggles and achievements. Through it all, I have not had to take a drink, nor have I ever been alone. You know, that's what's so wonderful, that we don't have to take this compulsive bites, and we're not alone. Willingness and action have seen me through it all with the guidance of a loving power. In other words, with the guidance of a loving God for me and the fellowship of the program. We have to understand that this has to do with the fellowship and I wrote something down. But anyway, it has to do with the fellowship as well as God. Because a lot of us knew God, maybe not trusted him, but we knew God. But it was when we came together to draw that circle around us. We drew that circle around us, and that we were able to have the strength that we needed. Well, I'll find that later. Okay, then it goes on to say, when I'm in doubt, I have faith. Remember, that's the spiritual principle. I have faith that things will turn out as they should. It'd be all right. It'd be all right. When I'm afraid, I reach the hand of another alcoholic to steady me. Life has not heaped monetary riches upon my head. You know, that's true for me. My husband, in the oil field crunch in the 80s, my husband took an early retirement. He was only 56 years old. It's a long time, a long way away, you know, from retirement. Scared me to death. You know, our salary was cut drastically. But you know, we made it. We made it. And we traveled more in that time than we had ever traveled in the time that he was working, because he had the time and I had the time. And my husband's a taxidermist, and that's not why I look so young. I just had to add that. Wanda said I needed to add that, because when I was speaking at the treatment center the other day, I was wanting to tell something about him being a taxidermist, and they just died laughing, you know. So now I got a new thing to say about that. But he's been a taxidermist since he was 16 years old. He started learning, and now, so that's what he fell back on after he retired from the oil field. And we have a shop in our backyard, and, you know, he also worked with another taxidermist for 7 years in order to have a regular income there. And so that helped us. But I had the wonderful, in 1997, I had the delightful opportunity to go to South Africa for OA.
Wow.
Yeah, I did. And my husband had the opportunity to go. And it came as a result of someone in the fellowship that loved us so dearly that gave him frequent flyer miles. Yeah. We spent 16 days in South Africa. Johannesburg, South Africa is the inner group that wanted someone to go there. They wanted someone from the East Coast. Because they had been having people from the West Coast, you know. And so the trustee of Region 9 and the chair of Region 9 said, well, what about Janice? She's from the Southeast. And so six weeks before the time to go, they called me and wanted to know if I wanted to go to South Africa. Who wouldn't? I didn't have a passport. Didn't have any of that, okay? So I started telling my husband. And I said, you know, they want me to, this guy from Houston that was real good friends of mine, he said, Janice, you need to go on a safari while you're there, you know. And so my husband's a hunter and a taxidermist, and so you can imagine, you know, telling him I was going to go on a safari. But anyway, you know, he was cool. But a couple of weeks later, this person called and said, they asked me if Jimmy was gone. I said, oh, no, there's no way that we can afford that, you know. And he said, if Jimmy had an airline ticket, could he go? And I said, yes. we could swing the rest, you know, because the tickets are not cheap. But anyway, he said, I want to give Jimmy some of my frequent flyer miles. So, boy, Jimmy got real happy then. he didn't have a passport either. And, I mean, it was like getting down to the wire, you know. So we made a trip to New Orleans to get him a passport. And I hadn't received mine yet because I had did it through the mail. And it was getting close, like 2 weeks, you know. And so I had them investigate where my wine was. And it was on a desk somewhere.
Oh, my God.
You know? And so that was really something, because I probably might have not got mine in the mail before it was time to go. Well, anyway, when Cape Town, South Africa, found out that I was coming, they wanted me to go there also. And that they would pay for my trip from Johannesburg, airline flight from Johannesburg to South Africa. And so I called this guy and I said, listen, I said, they want me to go to Cape Town. What are we going to do about Jimmy? He said, I have more miles. So he gave Jimmy the miles from Johannesburg to South Africa. And anyway, when we got to Johannesburg and we got on this this plane, we had to walk to the plane. And guess what that plane said? The love plane. You know, it was all decorated at the love plane. You know, what is it? Okay. Can I answer?
No.
We think that Johannesburg and Cape Town are both in South Africa.
They are.
Okay.
They are.
But they're far enough apart.
You have to fly.
Yeah, we were just discussing that.
Okay.
Sorry.
It was a two-hour flight. It was a two-hour flight from there. But anyway, it was a wonderful experience, and we got to go to Kruger National Park on a four-day safari. And, you know, everybody thinks because Jimmy's a hunter that he wants to kill everything he sees, but he doesn't. He kills it for the food, you know, and we do eat the wild game and stuff, and it's very delicious. And he really enjoyed it. We have a whole album. I wish I could bring my whole life, you know, in my pictures, but I can't. But we have, you know, beautiful pictures of that and everything. So I'm grateful for that opportunity to get to do that. And it's not because I've been heaped with monetary riches, except the love and the generosity of people, you know, in OA. When New Orleans was devastated by Hurricane Katrina, and I in a group we lost so many groups, we lost so many places for groups to meet, and people moved out of the New Orleans area. Some of them have never come back. And now we're back up to 13 groups in my inner group. But my inner group couldn't afford to send me to conference 1 year. And a friend of mine gave me a ticket to go. And they sent a request out that if people would like to send money for COLA because of the Katrina catastrophe and everything, so a delegate could go from that inner group. We got enough money. They sent enough money for the delegate to be able to go, and I was able to go. When I was nominated to run for vice chair, my inner group couldn't afford to send me. And I told them, I said, I don't know if I'm going to be able to be here. Because they and my sponsor today, is my sponsor, said money's no reason not to be here. But you don't understand. <You know? laughs> So anyway, one of my friends gave me a ticket to go to the Region 8 Assembly, and some other people gave money that so I could be there. And my inner group had a little money, so that was paid. That was paid for. So you know, I've been heaped a lot with love and monetary riches through the fellowship. And you know, that is just beyond my wildest dreams, you know. And I think, this is a mean thing I'm fixing to say, but I'm going to say it because it's true. My own brothers would not do that for me. And that is my truth, you know. My middle brother, he hardly knows I'm alive. I'm serious. You know, he never came to any of my children's weddings. He never came to our anniversary. I never, you know, hear anything from him. I tried to go and visit him because he lives right in the property where I was born. We had 12 acres of property, and my youngest brother got 3 acres, and he got 3 acres, and my oldest brother got 3 acres, and I got 3 acres, okay? So about 3 or 4 years ago, I sold my property, and I was able to buy my husband a truck. He tells me, my wife bought me that truck, and I love it. But I'm driving a 28-year-old Oldsmobile, a 98 Regency Oldsmobile. It is like almost in mint shape, okay? And everybody wants to buy that car from me, especially these black people at the airport. I mean, you know, they all swarming around my car looking, and I get a lot of service that way too, you know? But it's a four-door car. It's beautiful. The plush, you know, it's just, I wish I had a brand new one just like it. It was only 14 months old when I bought it, okay? Well, my husband's truck, he had a Ford truck, and it was just like ratty, you know, everything was broke on and everything. And so I decided that we were going to get him a truck, and we were going to travel in that truck, okay? That's our traveling car. And my car, my 28-year-old car, is just my little hackabout, and also I go to the airport, and it gets me where I want to go in very good comfort. It's very comfortable. And anyway, I've had a good mechanic all these years, and I also, he retired, and now I have another one. And this mechanic that I have now, he owned one of those. So he knows what they're made of, you know, and he keeps telling me, you just keep getting this car fixed. You just keep getting this car fixed. And I have 243,000 miles on it, same motor. And the life of the motor is changing the oil. It's a change in the oil. We are on our third transmission, okay? The first transmission, I was going up to Missouri to what is that arch thing? St. Louis, Missouri. We were going up there. And we got 40 miles from Memphis. And stranded in the middle of nowhere. Nowhere. They had two or three guys stopped. We didn't like the way they looked or what they said. And all of a sudden, they had this truck, that truck stopped. He had a Bible on his dashboard, and he had a cell phone. He was pretty safe. And so he was wonderful. And he knew about a transmission place in Memphis. Lord and Taylor, something like that. Taylor and something, I remember. But he got a hold of them and told them, you know, that in 2 days I needed to be in St. Louis and I needed to get a transmission fixed, okay? So they sent a tow truck. A beautiful truck came by us, and it said Elvis Presley Boulevard, and I am a fan of Elvis, okay? I just jumped up for joy. I was so happy. So here I was riding in this beautiful truck going to Elvis Presley Boulevard and then towing my 98 Oldsmobile in the back of us. Well, anyway, we got in there, and I told that man, I said, look, man, I said, I have to be in St. Louis by Friday. This was Wednesday. I have to be in St. Louis by Friday. I said, you got to get this car fixed because I am on a mission, you know. And they did. They put me ahead of everybody, and they fixed it for me. And on Friday morning, we took off back to, but I got to go to Graceland again. And I mean, I've been four times, you know, just four times. And I'll go again any chance I get. You know, because that man, Elvis, he gave something to my life. He gave me that being of energy and good looking and you know, music, that lively music. And as I shared yesterday, that our radio was in our kitchen, you know, and this music started coming across. There was wasn't all this country western music. It was this rock and roll, you know. Just loved it. We went to see all of Elvis's movies when we had our three kids. We were didn't hardly have any money, but we found money to go to the meeting, you know, to the movie and bring the kids and everything. And my husband, I mean, you know, we would go and we had these three kids, and he was buying popcorn for him and candy, whatever. And one time he forgot to buy something for our little girl. Our girl, she was in the middle, and she said, "Daddy, you forgot me. I got so many kids, I can't keep up with them." He only had three, and he couldn't keep up with them. So, I mean, you know, it was that kind of fun. The other night, Wanda's husband was watching Elvis Flaming Star, so I had to sit there and watch it with him, you know. The tail end of it. God, I got really sidetracked on this. about the monetary riches. It doesn't always come in money. Although money helps.
It does.
It does help. But money comes from places that you don't know that it will come from. And I'm grateful for each and every time. And you know, when just like this time, I was able to come in early and stay with Wanda. You know, I'm going to be away from home a week. And every time I go somewhere that I know people and all, they say, come and stay a few days, you know. And I have this friend that lives in Orlando, and she has free tickets to Disney World. You know, and we go to Disney every time I go there. You know, and I've been there many, many times. And we go have a day at Disney. You know, don't cost me anything. Just go to Disney. And that's just really, really fun. Well, okay. Life has not heaped monetary riches upon my head, nor have I achieved fame in the eyes of the world. My blessings cannot be measured in those terms. No amount of money or fame could equal what has been given me. Today I can walk down any street anywhere without fear of meeting someone of harm. Today my thoughts are not consumed with craving for the next drink or regret for the damage I did on the last drunk. Today I reside among the living, no better, no worse than any of God's other children. Today I look in the mirror when putting on my makeup and I smile. Rather than shy away from looking into the eye, today I fit in my skin. I am in peace with myself and the world around me. That's my story. That's my story. I used to pick on myself so much I'd bleed all over the place. You know, I just was so, my disease really took me to really damaging myself. And that's when that says that about looking in the mirror. You know, not trying to have to correct something, I'll pick that or something. Anytime there was a mosquito bite and I'm allergic to mosquitoes, I'd scratch it and scratch it until it would make a sore. I just couldn't, you know, stop from scratching on myself and everything. And every time there was a scab or something, I would pull it off and make it bleed some more, you know, just never would let it heal or anything. And you know, today I fit in my skin and I don't have to tear up my skin. And I haven't had to do that in a long, long time. A long, long time.
What page is that?
Excuse me? I'm on 318. I started on 317 and now I'm on 318. Today I fit it in my skin and I don't have to harm my skin and I'm at peace with myself and the world around me. Growing up in AA, I have been blessed with children who have never seen their mother drunk. I have a husband who loves me simply because I am, and I have gained the respect of my family. What more could a broken down drunk ask for? Lord knows it is more than I ever thought possible, and ever so much than I deserve. All because I was willing to believe that OA might work for me too. All because I believed that. And it does. My three children, they really honor me, and they respect me, and they love me. And my grandchildren, I mean, that's just like the icing on the cake. My little, I have a grandson, his name is Shane, and he's 17 years old. He's going to graduate from high school this year. And I love all my grandkids, but he is outspoken and says what he thinks. And he's blonde-headed and blue-eyed and just real cute. He's a baseball player, left-handed. I mean, you know, he's just real cute. And he's got a lot of self-esteem, you know. And one day we were having dinner over at my son's house. They live in my neighborhood. And we kind of like invited ourselves to dinner. My husband wanted to be there because my son had made a big pot of deer venison spaghetti sauce, okay? And I don't cook spaghetti because of the pot, you know, the pasta. I don't eat pasta, and he doesn't need it, I think. But he loves it, okay? And he gets it wherever he goes. And another reason why I don't his spaghetti sauce that much, he gets heartburn. You know, I'm trying to save the man. Save him misery of getting up at night eating Rolaids, you know. So after church, they were at church. We went to 4 o'clock on Saturday, and they were at church also. And Jimmy said, did Chad say anything about us going to eat with him? I said, no, he didn't. He said, you think he'd mind if we go? I said, I don't know, let's go see. You know? And so we went, and I said, you go in first. This is your idea, you know. And he went in, and he said, we came to eat spaghetti. And I told my daughter-in-law, I said, I can go home and fix a salad, you know, because I know I don't eat pasta. I'll go home and fix a salad, but I'll put the sauce on top of my lettuce and stuff. You know, that's how I eat the sauce. And she said, yeah, that would be nice. And so Shane drove me home, and he was sitting in my kitchen, and I was fixing the salad and everything. And he said, my grandkids call me Gonnie, G-O-N-N-I-E, Gonnie. And it was my oldest granddaughter that gave me that name, because we were saying Granny to her, and she couldn't, that's what came out of her mouth, was Gonnie. And I love it, because I wanted a special grandmother name, and I got it. I sure got it. They tell me that God gives you the desires of your heart. Well, anyway, I was up there, and I kind of had some tight pants on, you know, tight legs in my legs. And he said, you know what, Gonnie? He said, you got some good-looking legs for an old lady. That was the ultimate compliment. Because I am an old lady, and I do have good-looking legs. Isn't that adorable? Don't you just love it? You just love it. And one of the reasons why my legs look so good is because I ride my bike 4 miles almost every day. You know, when I'm at home, I ride 4 miles. I used to walk 4 miles, but my feet started bothering me, and I have much more fun riding my bike. And I just have more fun with the neighbors and everything. And one guy, he was my son's age. My oldest son is almost 52. He's going to be 52 on April the 9th. And I wear lipstick. I don't know if y'all know that. And, I like lipstick, and I like the way it looks, but I lick my lips when I don't have something on my lips, and so I'm always putting lipstick on. Well, anyway, this guy that's my son's age, or my daughter's age, one of them, in between, he likes for me to kiss him and put him a tattoo on his face, you know, and that started one Halloween, you know, for trick-or-treating and stuff. And so when I see him, no matter where I see him, he wants me to put him a tattoo on his face. And so he calls me Ruby Red Lips. And now he's got a son that's in his 20s. And guess what that guy's calling me? Ruby Red. He'll call me Ruby Red sometime, or Ruby Red Lips, or whatever. So when I'm riding, you know, I see these things, and say, hey, Ruby Red, you know, and just have so much fun out exercising, you know, and riding my bike. I have a lot of nicknames. I really do. And one of the ones that somebody that was on the board of trustees gave me years ago, he called me a WAQWA. WACW. WACW. And that means wild ass Cajun woman. and so that was my name when I was on the board of trustees, you know. And it was so funny because the staff even started calling me that, you know. So anyway, that was real fun. But right now my nickname mostly is Honey Bunny. And that's my friend that lives in Florida that I go to Disney World with. That she's the one that gave me that name. And so people will holler, hey, Honey Bunny. And I'll look around, you know, and didn't know. And I was up in New Hampshire. New Hampshire had flown up there to help this guy sell tapes up at Region 6. I've done that a couple of times. That was really, really fun. Have all your expenses paid to get to go to Region 6 convention. I mean, you know, we sold a lot of tapes for him, too. You know, we really did. And all of a sudden, way up there, I heard, hey, Honey Bunny, you know, and it was somebody that had met me in Florida and all. But I have a lot of fun with that. So, life is good. And it'd be all right.
Be all right.
It'd be all right. My little granddaughter, Shane's sister, her name is Lily. And she was an unexpected pleasure about 5 years. She's 5 years old now. She was born December the 17th. One of the sponsors I had was Jeannie. She sponsored me for 11 years. Jeannie stopped sponsoring me because she was traveling. Her husband retired, and like I wanted to kill that man. I feel like he just took her life away because she left OA. She left OA. And she became very, very dependent upon him. And she ended up losing her leg.
Oh, dear.
And she she died February the 12th of 2009. A little over a year. And I was told she didn't want visitors. And so about 3 or 4 days before she died, her husband called me and said, Janice, you can come see Jeannie. The woman was almost dead. You know, and finally he gave me permission to go see her. And when I went up, she recognized me. And she asked me, how's your Jimmy? Her husband's name was Jimmy also. How's your Jimmy? So I knew she knew me. And she said, she started mumbling something. And her husband said, she's saying the serenity prayer. And she, I went up to her and we said the serenity prayer. And she told me, she said, Janice, I'm so sorry. And that was her last words to me. And I don't know what that so sorry means. You know, I'm so sorry. And I said, well, God forgives us, you know, because I didn't know what she was really telling me. But anyway, she was able to go home that next day, and Jimmy and I went that Sunday to see her. He got to see her right before she died, and she recognized him and all, and she died, I think, from Sunday to Thursday, and then she died. But her husband called me and asked me if I would do the eulogy. And so I wrote what I wanted to say, and I entitled it Jeannie, My Forever Friend. And she was my forever friend. You know, she still is. But I feel like she gave her life to her husband, you know, and she didn't continue with her recovery and everything. She had severe diabetes. So when she stopped sponsoring me, I think it was in, I can't really remember. But this other lady that... Jimmy sponsored this other lady. Her name was Karen, and Karen and I had been talking, most especially when Jeannie was on her trips and stuff like that. And so when Jeannie called me on a Saturday and told me she was stopping sponsoring, she couldn't sponsor anymore, and about 2 hours later, I called Karen, and I asked her to be my sponsor. So in 2 hours, I had a sponsor. And so Karen had a lot of difficulty in her life. Her mother had Alzheimer's, and she was in her home, and finally had to put her in a nursing home. Her daughter got in almost a life and death accident. I mean, just took her a year to recover, and Karen was nursing her. And then after that, Karen's husband had a tumor in his brain and had to have surgery. And during that time of him recovering and everything, she started complaining about hurting in her side. She had cancer. And she wasn't tending to herself. She was tending to everybody else. And then she died. And she died on December the 14th of, 2005. We buried her on December the 16th. And Lily was born on December the 17th. It was a section, and we knew that's when she was going to be born. But it was like that was a replacement for me. And she's just a little character. They say she's like me. even her mama says she's like Miss Janice. She calls me Miss Janice. But anyway, one day, when I keep her and all, I have a lot of fun with her because her other grandmother is the one that just about raises her. You know, she keeps her while the mama works, and I didn't do none of that. Still don't. And so anyway, my husband said, you know, we raised our kids, you know. And I knew I would have a resentment if I had to stay home and take care of somebody's kids while they worked and all. That's just my makeup, you know. But anyway, one day I was talking to her and I talked and she didn't understand what I was saying. She said, what'd that mean? What'd that mean? And isn't that cute? When we don't understand, at 5 years old, she knew to ask what something really means, you know, and that's what I wanted to know, what that means in here, you know. And the other, she's going to have tubes put in her ears because she's been really sick with a lot of problems, and it's going to be next Friday. And I asked Loretta, I said, what does Lily say about that? She said, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that, you know. And when she goes to the bathroom, she lollygags and she sings and she just has a great time in the bathroom, stuff like that. And one day, I don't waste no time in the bathroom. You know, I just go and do my business and I'm out of there. And so one day I kept her and I was going to the bathroom and I came back out. She said, you pee fast. So a little while later, she went back to the bathroom. Went to the bathroom. She came out. She said, I pee fast. So I mean, it's all those precious, precious, precious things that, you know, come out of the mouth of those babes. Okay. Let's take a little break until 11:30, and then we'll go another half hour. I think lunch is at 12. Okay, let's regroup with the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. This guy was telling you. Steve was just telling me that his wife can whistle where his kids could hear a way, you know, way out. And it was reminding me of my husband. My father-in-law used to be a fox hunter, you know. Thank God Jimmy's a deer hunter. At least you get something to eat. A fox hunter, you didn't get nothing but hearing the dogs holler. But he had a horn. A deer horn, you know, horn. And so Jimmy got that horn. But he used to blow that horn for when the kids were in the back of the subdivision or something. And they hear that horn. And my daughter said that used to embarrass her so much because they knew that their daddy was calling him when he would blow that horn, you know. I would like, for the tape and all, we're just continuing after our little break. I would like to say that a disease is a condition that separates me from health, and my sickness is physical, mental, and spiritually. The book talks about our disease is physical and mental, not emotional. Although there's a lot of emotional disturbances that go on, but the emotional disturbances usually starts in our mind. We think that somebody said something or somebody did us something, and they may have, but we have to learn how to deal with the mental. And so in the doctor's opinion, Dr. Silkworth, he was not an alcoholic. But he treated a lot of alcoholics. I read in some of the AA literature that during Dr. Silkworth's lifetime, he treated 40,000 alcoholics.
Wow.
He was born in 1873 and he died in 1951. So he lived during my lifetime. And he died March the 22nd of a heart attack. You know, but he really was very instrumental in. Right now I'm on XXV, Roman numerals 25 is where I'm starting from. He talked about the people in AA. He said, this is the AA people talking. They believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, an estimate is to tell in detail so a reader can get a clear picture. And so there's a clear picture that was established through this information that Dr. William Silkworth gave those alcoholics. The AA said that convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, the chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital, which was Towns Hospital in Akron, Ohio, specializing in alcoholics and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. And in 1934, when Bill was a patient, he was a very competent businessman of good earning, but he was an alcoholic of a type that Dr. Silkworth regarded as hopeless. You know, this is Dr. Silkworth talking. But in the course of his third treatment, Bill had to go into treatment three times before he was able to get well. On Roman numerals 26, XXVI, this is a paragraph. This is a paragraph that is important to me. And it says, you may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. And to be able to rely absolutely on what these alcoholics said about themselves, I was able to start relying upon that. Yours very truly, William D. Silkworth. Duncan was his middle name, D-U-N-C-A-N, Duncan. And so this is the alcoholics talking again. It said that Dr. Silkworth, who had, at their request, gave them a letter. He had been kind enough to enlarge upon his views. He enlarged upon the views of the first letter that he had wrote. And in the statement, Dr. Silkworth confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that they must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. And that's what I have to understand. So I really believe that, you know, that it's a disease of ignorance, that we don't understand. We don't understand what we're really dealing with. On the next page, 27, when he said, we doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology, what he really would have wanted to say was some kind of a spiritual psychology, but being the doctor that he was, he didn't put that in there, was of urgent importance to alcoholics. But its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. In other words, they were not equipped to apply the power of God. And something that's synthetic is man-made. This had to be more than man-made. This had to be spiritual. And Dr. Silkworth knew that. But what he also knew is that there was something wrong with the body and the mind of the alcoholic. And I rely absolutely on that information. And that's why I can say I am a compulsive overeater and I know it. Because of this information that I have gleaned from this book. Okay, at the bottom of 27, it says, they believe in themselves and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. To be chronic, it never goes away. It just keeps going on over and over and over again. It never goes away, okay? Their alcoholism never went away. They found a treatment but they never found a cure. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. I changed this to, I knew that I needed to be freed from my craving for these craving-creating foods. And I use that term, because, trying to keep all my stuff in order, but Dr. Ed Dowling, he was a Jesuit priest. He was Bill Wilson's spiritual mentor. And when I went to the World Service office in Los Angeles, I was just blown away by getting the opportunity to go there. And now our World Service corporate office is in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, out of Albuquerque. And I was on the board of trustees the whole time that was in the planning stages. I was there when we went, when there was an empty field, I was there when they dug the first, they put the first shovel. I was there when they dedicated the office. And when I walked into that building and I saw those boxes and boxes and boxes of literature being shipped out all over the world, It just went all through me. If you ever have a chance to go to the World Service office, I would encourage y'all to do that, because it's an awesome, awesome experience. But this article, in 1992, this article of Father Downing was on the bulletin board in the World Service office at that time. I don't know if it still is. I don't know. But This is what he said. He said, let me see if I can read this. My 240-pound gluttony gave me two heart attacks. An alcoholic doctor got me down toward 180 when he advised a total AA abstinence from starch, butter, salt, and sugar. He said these four foods were probably my alcohol. Abstinence was so much easier than temperance. The balanced diet often prescribed was loaded with these four craving-creating appetizers. I was like a lush tapering off on martinis. Only after the discovery of the AA approach to craving-creating intake did I realize that the Jesuit Ignatius' first rule for diet in his spiritual exercise was to go easy on craving, creating food and drink. Wow. 1960, that was written. 1960 was an OA originated. January 19th, 1960. Okay. This is from the Grapevine, which is the AA magazine. It was published in November 1982. So I treasure this. I keep it. But that's why I say this. That's why I say this on this paragraph. Of course, a compulsive overeater ought to be freed from their physical craving for creating foods. And this often requires a definite abstinence procedure. There's a procedure that goes into abstinence, you know, starting to eliminate certain foods and stuff like that, before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. And, you know, psychological is reasons why people act, think, or feel as they do. And then they go on, a procedure is to carry on an action, you know, willingness and action. Willingness has to be followed by action. And they say that we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol, in other words, for me, is that action of that craving-creating food on this chronic compulsive overeater is a manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate overeater or drinker. These allergic types can never safely use these craving-creating foods in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found that they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon human things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. And then this next paragraph is so powerful. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. In other words, a shallow emotional request is never enough. It's never enough. Anything that's shallow is never enough. It has to be deep. And it has to be deep in me. My foundation is critical. It is very critical. It must be deep enough and solid enough to withstand stresses. It's got to be solid enough and deep enough to withstand stresses. Because those mounting emotional feelings and thinking is going to happen to us. I mean, I have shared a few of the things that's severe that has happened to me throughout my years of OA recovery. It says that the message that can interest and hold these alcoholic people, it must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their life. Okay? That's a promise. That is a promise. I'm not going to be able to reach all the promises, but that is definitely a promise. I wish I could find that little card that I read earlier about, you know, I can't redo my past, but I can recreate the end. I can recreate the end. And I think that that's what that's telling me. We need to recreate our lives. And it also talks about that we were reborn. We can't be reborn physically, but we can be reborn spiritually. And that's what this is talking about. Okay, at the bottom when they say men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the truth from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are what? Restless, irritable, and discontented, unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. That's the bitch. Others can do it. I can't. Restless means that I'm uneasy. Irritable means I'm easily annoyed. And discontent, it means I'm never satisfied. Okay? So when I'm uneasy, or I'm easily annoyed, or I'm never satisfied, that's a danger signal. That's a real danger signal. And you know, this is the first description of untreated alcoholism. And when that happens to me, I am in the throes of untreated compulsive overeating. And I need to get my treatment. And my treatment is to work my steps, to call my sponsor, to talk with others. One of the things that on page 75, I love to cross-reference my book. On page 75, you can keep hold that page, but I want to share what this means to me. Wait, is it 75? Wait. No, 75. Now, these are the promises of step 5, okay? It says that we pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. And once we have taken this step, step five, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. You know, that same thing that we looked for food to ease us, we can do work our steps to ease us. And so that is my treatment. It goes on to say, our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel that we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. All promises. Also on page 55, and the reason why I'm so smart is because I put page numbers in the lines of my book. I can't remember all of this. But I write in my book, and I put my cross-reference numbers. But my book is telling me right now on page 55, they're going to talk again about that broad highway. Wait, yeah. I want to start on, actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be.